The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6:01. Next is Bread and Roses, and tonight we talk about The Color of Food, a multimedia and book project created to amplify, preserve, and celebrate the stories of Black, Latino, Indigenous, and Asian farmers and food activists working to revolutionize the food system in our communities. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio invites you to our springtime open house and live in-studio performance of Mama C, Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m. Welcome. Tour the KBOO studios and meet your community. Share refreshments and talk with other listeners, program hosts, volunteers, and KBOO staff. See how our communities intersect and work together to create this amazing community radio station. We'll also have a live performance by Mama C, an accomplished musician, poet, and MC, as well as a former Black Panther and political refugee who fled the U.S. in early 1970s for Tanzania. Again, that's Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m., an open house and live performance by Mama C at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We look forward to seeing you.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Bread and Roses. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. Women have had this forum on KBOO since 1978. That's 37 years. The Bread and Roses Collective always welcomes new collective members, no experience necessary. So if you would like to host, produce, or engineer with us, contact KBOO's volunteer manager at volunteer@kboo.org. You can also find Bread and Roses on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to past shows, share comments or show ideas. And of course, we are on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. I'm your host this evening, Delphine Crescenzo, and our engineer is Chris DeMaria. Tonight on Bread and Roses, we talk about The Color of Food, a multimedia and book project by Natasha Bowens, created, quote, to amplify, preserve, and celebrate the stories of Black, Latino, Indigenous, and Asian farmers and food activists working to revolutionize the food system in our communities. I interviewed Natasha Bowen on the phone last week, and during our conversation, we talked about the historical trauma associated with land cultivation in the U.S. and the importance to also celebrate the incredible contributions of communities of color to agriculture and food activism. Natasha Bowens is an author, beginning farmer, and community activist who focuses on building empowerment and community with food and storytelling. She spent the last 5 years gathering stories from Black, Native, Asian, and Latina farmers and food activists around the country for her book, The Color of Food: Stories of Race, Resilience, and Farming. She started the multimedia project in 2010 after exploring race, food, and agriculture on her blog, Brown Girl Farming, and for Grist magazine. Her work has now garnered national media attention such as The Atlantic, CNN, Bill Moyers, and Color Lines. You can find her work at thecolorofood.org and at live exhibits and storytelling presentations nationwide. And the book will be out in April, published by New Society Publisher. I started by asking Natasha Bowens to share her personal story, becoming a farmer and blogging at Brown Girl Farming. Here is Natasha Bowens. Welcome to KBOO and Bread and Roses.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you can talk a little bit first about your own personal journey becoming a farmer. What were you doing before? Was, you know, farming or growing food in your family heritage? Was it something you were coming back, or was it something that you were brand new at? And why did you decide to farm?
Yeah, so it wasn't something in my immediate family heritage, and it became something that that kind of motivated me to look further into my family history to find the farmers. But I did that after I started farming. So my motivation to farm, I didn't grow up around farms. I didn't grow up farming at all. I really shocked my family when I announced to them I wanted to be a farmer. And it really came out of kind of an activist beginning. Mm-hmm. I was working as an environmental activist for a couple years, and then I was working in D.C., Washington, D.C., as a healthcare advocate and kind of social justice advocate. I was working for the Center for American Progress, mm-hmm. and it really just hit me all of a sudden that food was at the center of all of these issues that I cared so deeply about. Environmental degradation, looking at health of our society, and mm-hmm. looking at social justice issues, I really started to see food as the elephant in the room. The way that we grow our food, the way that the kind of food that we have access to, and all of the diet related illnesses tied to that food. So I became kind of obsessed mm-hmm. with food suddenly. And really started immersing myself in the local food movement and educating myself, reading a lot of books, going to conferences. I started growing my own food in my backyard, volunteering on urban farms there in Washington, D.C., working at farmers markets. And sooner or later, I decided to leave my job and pursue full-time learning how to farm organically. And that's kind of how I entered the world of farming.
And so as you were starting to farm, you also decided to start blogging about it because talk a little bit about the media representation that you found there around farmers of color in particular.
Yeah, so I started farming and I was loving every bit of it. And I was farming both in the city and outside of the city in more of a rural area in West Virginia. As you know, around D.C., there's quite a many states mm-hmm. in and around D.C. And in that experience, I really saw a glaring disparity and inequity, not only in the food system itself and seeing, okay, where are the farmers' markets? Are they in communities of color or not? Are there farmers of color at these markets? At the conferences I was going to and the books I was reading, I noticed, this was a very homogenous mm-hmm. kind of world I had entered. And while I was out on the farm feeling like I was the only brown girl around, you know, I just really had a lot of questions and a lot of thoughts, and it really hit me heavily. And so I started writing about it, and I named my blog Brown Girl Farming. And I was soon picked up by Grist Magazine, where I started writing a series called The Color of Food, and started hearing from farmers and food activists of color all over the country, and found out that I wasn't alone in my frustration with the inequities that I was seeing, not only in the media representation of farming in the food system itself, and the frustrations with the disparities in that regard.
And before we talk a little bit more about what that may be, maybe you could describe for us a little bit of the historical context of people of color farming here in the United States and its legacy, right? Starting with colonialism, the taking of the land, the slave trade, and then Chinese, Mexican immigration, etc. How all of those different things have affected farming in communities of color especially?
Yeah, well, I always like to start out by saying, and one of the real motivations for the Color of Food book is to definitely recognize the historical context of farming and the pain and trauma that it has caused for a lot of communities of color, but also to remember that before that pain and trauma, you know, people were just farming.
Yeah.
The first stewards, the first agriculturists of this land, as we know, were indigenous Native Americans here on this land. And that knowledge and that legacy of stewarding this land is so precious and so sacred, and we really have to honor and recognize that, while at the same time recognizing, yes, their land was taken from them. They were moved to land, you know, that was not their own, and their harvesting and farming and hunting, their food ways were kind of taken from them, the rights of their food ways. Mm-hmm. And as a result, now we see Native American communities living on reservations with some of the highest rates of poverty and the highest rates of diabetes and obesity and diet-related illnesses. And so it's really important to connect the dots of what happened there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then also to remember that there are still communities that are preserving those food ways and still practicing those food ways and trying to educate their communities about bringing these food ways back, because that is true food sovereignty. And the same goes for, you know, the African American community here in America. Again, some of the first agriculturists of homelands in Africa, you know, carried those skills and that knowledge of agriculture here, and you know, were forced into agriculture through slavery. And you know, that has been very traumatic in the Black community. Still, there were so many farmers that I interviewed, Black farmers, that talked about kind of, one farmer called it the anti-agricultural blacklash, and kind of how many in the Black community still feel that trauma. And still tie that negative stigma to agriculture, right, because of the strong impact that it had over the course of history, and therefore maybe shy away from the trade of farming now today. So, and the same goes for a lot of communities that came here from other countries. You mentioned China and Mexico, but also Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, Haiti. You know, there are all kinds of folks that have migrated here and have been kind of left with no other choice but to get into agriculture, working for conventional farms as farm workers where they're oppressed and humiliated. And so there's a lot of trauma tied to agriculture for these communities, but we have to, you know, one thing that I really advocate for is healing from that and definitely recognizing that, but trying to move past that and see the legacy and the knowledge and the sacred wisdom that these communities mm-hmm. carry in agriculture that we have to keep alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you point out there was farming before those traumatic historical events have happened, mm-hmm. and some people that have carried those ways through. Actually, recently, Winona LaDuke, who is a huge mm-hmm. activist around yeah. Native food system, was sharing a story of Pawnee seeds that have been taken from the Pawnees when they were relocated. So they mm-hmm. took those seeds with them to Oklahoma, and now they were actually approached recently by some people back in their ancestral land who are wanting them to bring some of these seeds and try to plant them back in the soil where they were first grown hundreds of years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. This is Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and we'll return to my interview with Natasha Bowens shortly, but I decided to actually go ahead and play for you the full story of the Pawnee seeds I just mentioned, told by Winona LaDuke herself. That was last October at Portland State University, PSU, during a keynote address for their Portland State of Mind Campus Sustainability Day. So here is Winona LaDuke.
That last picture is a picture of, it's known as Pawnee Eagle Corn. And just, you know, I went and I asked Deb Echohawk if I could tell this story, because that came from her. But this is the story I'm going to tell you. And it's important to remember because it links corn and our peoples. So the Pawnees were once the Arikara people, and they lived in the northern Missouri River, the place that is now known as the Fort Berthold Reservation. The Northern Agricultural Empire on the Missouri River, kind of like the Nile Delta of North America. And I think it's really important to think about that because the trade routes were so substantial in the north from around that territory. And those people grew really a wide variety of vegetables and foods. And so it is there that they came to from their story. They descended from the sky. And when they descended from the sky, what I was told is that the man came down in a buffalo robe and the woman came down in a corn husk. And I say that because this is something about how food is not just something you get at the store. Food is something that comes from the Creator, and it is a part of who we are as peoples. So they grew those varieties and they lived well, and that at a certain point, they decide that they are going to leave. And they moved south, and they became the Pawnees. They split off. And when they lived down there in Nebraska, they lived well. And the way it was told to me was that they did pretty good, and the settlers came, and they still got on pretty good with the settlers. And when they was with the settlers, they would trade, and what Deb Echohawk told me was that she was said, we were kind of like AAA. If your horse was lame, you go see the Pawnees, you know? If you need something fixed, they go work back and forth, you know. And I want to say that because people can have good relationships with people that are settlers that come in. It is the nature of, you know, how the relationship is formed. And so then what happened is that the federal government came in and messed stuff up. And when the federal government came in and messed stuff up, they forced those people to move in three separate forced removals to Oklahoma. And in that, those people lost a great deal. They lost their people. They lost their land. They lost the place of their ancestors. And then they also lost a lot of their foods because their foods would not grow in Oklahoma. And so they grieved, and that historical grief that our people have and trauma. And so it took many years and they kept losing their seeds. And then one day, this woman named Ronnie O'Brien from the Archway Museum in Kearney, Nebraska, called down to the Pawnee Tribal Council and said, I am in your homeland, and I'd like to try to grow some traditional seeds for the Pawnees. That's what she said. And they said, you have to talk to Deb Echohawk. And so I met both these women, and they told me this story. And so Deb said that she called, and she said, I don't know what to do. She said, we don't have a lot of seeds, because they had very few left. And so she said she talked to their elders committee, and the elders committee deliberated long and hard, and then they said, you know, we're going to send some of those seeds back to our homeland. And so the descendants of the settlers in the Pawnee homeland grew the seeds of the Pawnees in their old territory. And what Deb told me was that the seeds remembered the land they came from. And so the seeds flourished. And so the recovery of a lot of the Pawnee seeds was by bringing them back to the Pawnee homeland. And in that process, this relationship developed. And 4 years ago, they had Welcome Home Pawnee Days in Kearney, Nebraska. And 150 Pawnees came up on buses, and 8,000 people came out to see them. And so I tell you that story because it is a story of corn. And corn, one of the greatest foods in the world, did not exist in nature. It only exists because of humans. It began as teosinte, and it was adapted, and with the love and attention of humans, corn came to be in all its glory and all its varieties. And so we are not bad. We can do great things if we do them well.
He has a piece of wisdom from Wainanalu Duke and telling her this incredible story of the Pawnee seed. So let's go back to my interview with Natasha Bowen about her book, The Color of Food. She is the producer of this incredible multimedia project, and she actually went on to tell me of another story very similar to the one Wainanalu Duke just shared with the Cherokee. Here she is.
I heard a similar story from one of the farmers I interviewed, Kevin Welch of the Center for Cherokee Plants. He's on the Cherokee Nation. And he talked similarly of, you know, during the Trail of Tears when Cherokee were forced to abandon their homelands and go elsewhere, and they did carry their seeds with them. Mm-hmm. And the Center for Cherokee Plants is actually, their mission is to bring back some heirloom Cherokee plants. And so they're kind of a seed bank where they're bringing back a lot of these seeds that have been lost and propagating them and giving them out in garden kits to all the residents on the Cherokee Reservation. And this is the eastern band of Cherokee in Cherokee, North Carolina. Yeah. So it's just really beautiful, the resilience that can happen through food.
Mm-hmm. And also acknowledging, right, the actual contributions to the advancements also of the field of agriculture. Lots of stories that you've been sharing through your blog and through the book that's coming out that exemplify really the overwhelming contributions of people of color to the field of farming, to agriculture. You know, giving the credit where the credit is due. And for example, you recently published an article on Mother Earth News about Dr. Booker T. Watley. Could you share a little bit of his story with us?
Yes. So we all know the CSA, the Community Supported Agriculture, and I was actually reading an old article posted by the Black Land Project with Grist Magazine, where the Black Land Project is a great project that documents relationships between the Black community and land. And that was the first place that I read about Booker T. Watley inventing this concept of CSA. So I decided to do a little more research. And, you know, the concept of the CSA, the history of it, is commonly said to have started in 1986 here in the U.S., credited to European and Japanese models that came over. But Booker T. Watley, who was born in 1915 in Alabama and was a professor at Tuskegee, a horticulturist, and just an advocate for, an early advocate for sustainable agriculture, one of the pioneers, he came up with the concept that he called clientele membership clubs. And he came up with this in the 60s and 70s, really. He'd been advocating for just kind of smarter, smaller farming. And he's written a book entitled Booker T. Watley's Handbook on How to Make $100,000 Farming Just 25 Acres. And he's kind of known for, you know, what's called the Watley Plan for Small Farms, where he talks about how the farm has to provide year-round cash flow, that they should be a pick-your-own operation, which we know pick-your-own farms are very popular today, and should have a guaranteed clientele market through these clientele membership clubs. And if you check out the post on Mother Earth News, you'll see a clip from an interview that he did with Mother Earth News, coincidentally, in 1982. So that's 4 years before, you know, what many believe to be the start of the CSA concept. He explains the clientele membership, and it is word for word pretty much what a CSA is, today's CSA is. And so Booker T. Watley was a black farmer, and he was coming up in Alabama during a time when the kind of decline of the number of black farmers was really starting to go down. And, you know, I think he was trying to find a way to continue the livelihood of these small farmers. But you never hear this story. You never hear him credited for such a successful concept that so many farms are using today, like 12,000 CSA farms. Mm-hmm. That's just one example of some of the many, many contributions that many, many different communities and farmers that are overlooked today.
Why, in your opinion, is that? Why is it that we repress or we don't talk about, we don't give recognition to these great contributions of people of color in farming? And what are the far-reaching consequences of this, not just for folks of color, but also for you know, American society as a whole?
Yes, well, you know, the question as to why really is the simple answer is just the racism and discrimination that's been woven deep into our, mm-hmm. our society's infrastructure since our society, you know, what we call our society now, began, right? So, and it's not just in farming. We know that it's pervasive in a lot of, in all of our systems. Mm-hmm. And though we've had decades of slow progress and fighting racism in America, we all know that it is still very much alive. And these are kind of the consequences of a system that has been based on that, with that kind of power dynamic. And you get misrepresentation, you get vast inequities and disparities across the board. And the far-reaching consequences of something so simple as we're not crediting people that should be credited, we're overlooking communities, we're misrepresenting communities, is vast. In my opinion, the connection that I've made, the hypothesis that I have, is that, you know, if you look at the picture and it's a homogenous picture and people are being left out, and then you look at the numbers, if you look at the agricultural census according to the 2012 USDA census, mm-hmm. we have 96% white farmers, and it hasn't always been that way.
Yeah.
In 1920, black farmers were about a million strong, but because of discriminatory practices by the USDA, which you can follow if you look into the Pigford lawsuit settlements that just came about, you can see, you know, this slow decline of the numbers of black farmers because they're being left out of the system, they're being denied loans, they're being foreclosed on. So it's a much larger issue that we're dealing with, but it trickles down and ends up, you know, with all of these consequences. And, you know, I talk to a lot of farmers about the misrepresentation as far as the media is concerned. And I think one farmer in Atlanta, an urban farmer, Eugene Cook, said it best. He was describing to me, just looking at a magazine, a very popular magazine in Atlanta, and it was a feature on urban farming in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the farmers featured were not black farmers, and there's a lot of black-led urban farms in Atlanta. And Atlanta has a very large African American population, mm-hmm. and so it was also a misrepresentation of the whole population. And he thought, he at the time was working at Truly Living Well, which was the farm there that had a lot of paid apprentices, trainees who wanted to be urban farmers, and a lot of folks from different communities of color. And he thought, okay, so they're opening this magazine, they're not seeing themselves here. Mm-hmm. So that is just, you know, a hurt to their own pride. But what about if my son or a young black man opens this magazine who represents one of the largest populations looking for work in Atlanta,
yeah.
Young black men, and they don't see themselves represented, then in that moment, all automatically, it's, you know, the theory is that well, I'm not there. This isn't for me. I couldn't get a job doing this. This isn't a line of work that I could do. I'm not represented there. So the consequences of this misrepresentation and this overlooking of all these populations are vast. If we want to recruit as many young farmers as possible as the farming population ages, then we have to be inclusive in the representation, and the accessibility of this trade has to be there for everyone.
Absolutely. And for me also, the depiction of farming as something that white people do in this country is very misleading. If you were to walk by any field, especially those that grow for mainstream grocery stores, and you will see mainly people of color there. And so I feel that that disconnect is also huge with understanding the farm labor issue.
Yeah, absolutely. The grocery stores and all of the food products love to paint the picture of the blonde, smiling, small family farm, and that is not the picture of what's going on the farm. You're exactly right.
If we want to be seen as an equal, if we want to be free, people, then plant the seeds, plant the seeds, plant the seeds.
Back in the day we used to raise our maize, planting the seeds and feeding of the people. Today my boys grow to be strong men. I teach by example, they break the cycles of oppression. The gifts to my world as I witness their actions. I see their kindness, respectfulness, and old soul wisdom. My love and I grounded, nothing can stop us. Our family is the circle pushing out with the collective. Plant the seed. So if we want to make a change, we must learn how to swim again. To understand the water is to understand the sun. And to ignite our power, we must collect to the power of one. Cultivate my freedom, true responsible awareness. And by turning up the soil, we seed our dreams and bury resentment. The reason why and where we plant the traditional way is to harvest our decisions to revolutionize each day. Plant the seed.
Listening to Bread and Roses, I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We just finished listening to Digging Roots, Plant the Seeds. Tonight, I'm playing an interview with author, farmer, and activist Natasha Bowens about her book and multimedia project, The Color of Food, created, quote, to amplify, preserve, and celebrate the stories of Black, Latino, Indigenous, and Asian farmers and food activists working to revolutionize the food system in our communities. In this last part of my interview with Natasha Bowens, I ask her to describe in detail the Color of Food multimedia project. So would you talk a little bit about the multimedia project, which is now a book? The Color of Food is coming up very soon. What are the stories that you share in this project, and how did you collect them?
Yeah, so the multimedia project started out about 5 years ago now. And, you know, it really just started out as a photographic storytelling project that was, you know, like I said, came out of my own personal experience. And as I started to see the impact that it was having on other folks, as I heard from them, it just kind of grew. And the next step just became inevitable. I was able to do a fundraising campaign on one of the crowdsource fundraising websites and raise the money to get on the road and go out and hear from farmers and food activists in Black, Latina, Native, and Asian communities across the country. And I went out and talked to over 75 different folks, all kinds of different farms, all different regions of the country, and just, you know, really got their stories, their very personal stories. While we definitely get some insight into the different issues with the food system and the food movement itself and some historical context of injustices for communities of color, it's also really about these farmers and their personal struggles and achievements, their personal connection to the land and different cultural food ways that they've, you know, advocated for and preserved in their work. And so from there, the kind of project grew, and I was able to get a publisher with New Society Publishers and decided to publish these stories in a photographic storytelling book. So there'll be portraits of the farmers as well as their story. And the project also lives online and on my blog, as you mentioned, and also is presented in live exhibits at different universities and conferences across the country. So it's all about getting these stories out there and just and these faces out there, just kind of changing the face of the food movement.
And another incredible thing that you've done is also compile a map where people can locate actually the farm. Are these the farm that you visited? How do farmers of colors out there end up on the map?
Yeah, so the map isn't where I would like it to be. It was kind of, it took the back burner, I guess I could say, while working on the book. And it, but yes, there is a map piece, and the ambition was to try to get as many farmers of color listed on there as possible, but it is voluntary. So I don't sign any farmers up. They sign themselves up. There's a few hundred farmers that have signed up on there. And some of them are farmers that I interviewed, others did not, but you can find the map online, and it's been a great tool. I've had a lot of young people mainly using it to find farms that they want to work on or farmer mentors, and so that is wonderful. That's what it's been used for.
And so as, you know, we conclude our conversation, I'd love if you can share a little bit from interacting with farmers and their families and also taking up farming yourself. What, in your opinion, are the effects of farming on families, on the community? How do we promote this with youth, and what kind of values do they help us you know, love for our life?
Yeah, so it's interesting that you bring up family, because I think being out on the road, it was such an honor to be welcomed into the homes of so many farmers. I got to stay with many of the farmers, break bread with many of the farmers, and really be welcomed into their families. And I think with everyone that I interviewed, community, you know, as the broader term for family, was at the center of what they were doing, right? I mean, there were, I can't even think of one farmer who wasn't doing this for community. I think that the preservation of community building, and the preservation of the community food ways and the cultural food ways was really at the center of a lot of what these farmers were doing. And, you know, the farm is a community space. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of farmers, older farmers that I interviewed, who talked about how things used to be and mm-hmm. how farming was a lot more communal than it is now. We've moved into the industrial farming concepts where, you know, it's just one guy out there on his tractor or, you know, just a team of workers out there. It used to be the community. Everyone kind of farmed. Maybe one person was raising hogs, one person was raising vegetables, and everyone just shared the work and shared the harvest. And it wasn't just around farming. It was everything that went on in that community, and we've really gone away from that. And I heard a lot of kind of yearning for that to come back from a lot of these farmers. And it's interesting because you see now how it is coming back in a way. If you think about some CSAs where they want the members to come out and work on the farm, and you're seeing the return of, like, community kitchens and co-ops, and, you know, you can tell that as a society we've kind of maybe even subconsciously realized how far away from the importance of community we've moved, and we're trying to bring that back while forgetting that this is, you know, our ancestors have these answers for us. You know, our elders that are still with us now, they have these answers for us because this is how they used to live. This is what farming was and still can be. And so, yes, that was a huge piece that I took away. But in saying that, I also want to emphasize a lot of what Farmer said was that this is a way to be self-sufficient. Yeah. So whether it means you're there by yourself doing it or doing it as a community, the point is that you're not dependent on a larger system that has historically failed you, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think that's one piece to change the conversation when there is a negative stigma for young people to get into farming, is to remember that if you have the skills to grow your own food and to own and steward your own land, there's nothing more powerful than that. There's nothing more self-sufficient than that.
Mm-hmm. And last words maybe about how this farming journey, both visiting farms but also starting your own, what kind of impact this has had on you, and what would be your words of encouragement for anybody who has maybe the same idea as you, quitting their day job and starting a farm?
Well, I have to say that farming is hard work, and there's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of young farmers get into this thinking that we get to frolic around in the fields. And we get to do a little bit of that, but it's definitely a lot of hard work. But for me, there's nothing more rewarding. And as far as the journey and being able to interview all these farmers, the knowledge and that I've been able to absorb from them has just been life-changing and completely invaluable. And so for anyone getting into farming, you know, yes, there are plenty of resources and books out there, but go find farmers in your community, elder farmers, and just sit at their knee, because I think, again, we cannot overlook these communities and the knowledge they carry.
Well, thank you so much, Natasha Bowens, for joining us and for sharing.
Just a little walk. rain. On my shoulder will rain. On my shoulder will rain. On my shoulder will rain. On my shoulder.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We just finished listening to Miklit Hedero, You and the Rain. Tonight, I played for you an interview with author, farmer, and activist Natasha Bowens about her book and multimedia project, The Color of Food, created to amplify, preserve, and celebrate the stories of Black, Latino, Indigenous, and Asian farmers and food activists working to revolutionize the food system in our communities. You can find the project online, thecolorofffood.org, and the book is coming out in April. Well, in the last minutes of the show, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from the book, The Color of Food, Stories of Race, Resilience, and Farming, from a chapter called Fierce Farming Women. In honor of International Women's Day, who was last Sunday, and Women's History Month, which is the month of March, Natasha Bowens is releasing excerpts of her book on MotherEarthNews.com, stories of fierce women farmers that she encountered while working on the project. So this is what she writes in this blog post entitled Fierce Farming Women, Part 1. I have never felt more like a woman than the day I dug my hands into the soil for the first time. I'll never forget the feeling of my hands after my first season farming. They were rough and tattered, and I like to think that describes the hands of every female farmer out there. It's a description that challenges society's definition of feminine beauty. However, With women making up over 70% of the world's farmers, I'd say we need to change the picture of feminine beauty to the image of a farmer's hands. Women feed the world. We always have. We've been the gatherers, the cooks, the one to provide milk to our babies, the nutritionists, the healers, and even the farmers. According to the International Center for Research on Women, rural women produce 80% of the world's food. That's an astounding contribution to the survival of humanity. To have ownership over such a vital contribution is something to praise. Meet Sandra Simone, a mother, widow, and jazz singer, who is raising goats on her family's historic land that grows wild with huckleberries. Sandra owns and operates Huckleberry Hill Farm in Talladega County, Alabama. Here is an excerpt from Sandra's story from The Color of Food, entitled Alabama Strong. We blow into Alabama from Tennessee, from the cool Smoky Mountains. My partner and I descend into sticky, sweet Alabama and head towards rural Talladega County, where I know of a woman farming alone and raising goats. After we arrive at her Huckleberry Hill Farm, farmer Sandra Simone puts up right to work. She and my partner begin working on her old tractor while I hold all the tools along with my recorder and start asking questions. The goats mill in the pasture behind us as if awaiting the tractor's return to action so their new grass seed can be planted. "Girl, I was a singer," Sandra begins in her silky, smooth voice as her long braids sway over the engine of the faded red Ford Jubilee tractor. "I never thought I'd be out here doing all this. I was always a city girl. I grew up in Birmingham and then moved to California and lived in Long Beach for 22 years. My late husband and I raised our daughters there. I had always wanted to sing since my earliest consciousness, but I had a lot of fear. But then I met my husband, Harold Burke, and he changed me. He flipped me from someone lacking self-confidence to someone who believed in possibilities. I began acting in plays and dancing and painting and having art exhibits, and I love all of it. We then decided to move to Alabama to get back to our southern roots and really develop my jazz singing career. My husband was so supportive. He was the wind beneath my wings. Meanwhile, he was busy talking to me about black-owned land. While still living in Long Beach, we would visit my mother, who had moved from Birmingham back to her birthplace of Alpine, Alabama. Harold was impressed with the amount of land my great-grandfather had acquired there. I was told by a great-uncle that it was originally about 2,000 acres. My great-grandfather arrived in America in about 1868. He had worked his passage from Mozambique and landed in Mobile. Why he chose this area, I don't know. I was told that the hills and the red clay soil reminded him of his home in Africa. He had quite a sustainable operation here. His family was large, 12 children. They produced what they consumed, sheep, cows, and pigs, and vegetable, and they even had goats. There was a spinning wheel used to make clothing from the sheep's wool. He had a blacksmith shop, a sawmill, and a general store. Most of the land was sold through the years. It's no longer 2,000 acres. What was left was divided into parcels that went to his 8 surviving children. Then, you know, it started passing down through generations and became more subdivided. My husband really began educating me about the importance of keeping the land here. He kept talking about how black-owned land is getting away and how important it was what my great-grandfather accomplished and how we shouldn't let it be lost. It took a while, but I finally heard him. We eventually took on the 40 acres instead of selling, like so many of my relatives did. It was just nice having the land, coming to get away from it all, connecting with nature and honoring my great-grandfather's legacy. Next thing you know, Harold and I were planning how we could put a little cabin that will allow us to live here and see what we could accomplish on the land. We put things into motion, and after a year or so of planning, we started building this beautiful little cabin. But before the cabin was completed, Harold was diagnosed with terminal cancer. Within a few short months, he made his transition and passed on. Sandra, heartbroken, in the home she dreamt into fruition with the man who made her unafraid to dream, now had a choice to make. She could stay on the land alone and preserve her family's legacy of Black land ownership and live off the land, or she could go back to Atlanta to be near her daughters and heal from her loss. Pulling from an inner strength deep within herself, she decided to continue living out here in her husband's vision on the land. Now, a single Black female farmer, Sandra has not only overcome heartbreaking loss, but she has mounted the hurdles that exist for Black farmers and female farmers, and she continues to meet those challenges. Sometimes I think about everything Harold did for me when he was alive, says Sandra. And now here I am running a farm, working on tractors, doing everything myself, and learning that I'm capable of. Sandra now stewards 100 acres of her family's historic land, raising meat goats and running an organic CSA farm. She sits on the board of the Southeastern African American Farmers Organic Network and was awarded 2012 Farmer of the Year by the Alabama NRCS. That day, I drove away from Huckleberry Hill Farm with Sandra's jazz album in the CD player. I listened to her voice singing low and strong and knew that Sandra's strength runs deep. It runs deeper than what you might see by looking at her rough and tattered hands on the farm. It's the kind of strength that has mended her heart and pushed her forward to feed her community. It's the pure strength of a fierce farming woman. This was an excerpt from the book, The Color of Food, Stories of Race, Resilience, and Farming, from a chapter called Fierce Farming Women. Read it online on MotherEarthNews.com, and this was part one, so other stories of fierce farming women will be coming out from Natasha's book on that blog. Well, thank you all for listening to Bread and Roses. We are a collective of women-identified radio activists, and we bring you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. Next week, I will be back with Ms. Zoe Pilyefus for a conversation on reproductive justice and the state of maternal health policies with guest Judith Arcana, Inanna Jehudi, and a representative from Portland, Planned Parenthood chapter. Have a good week, everyone, and I'm going to leave you with Eric de Jesus, Oxelot. This is Canción para los Cargoles Zapatista. Have a good night.
Nosotras las mujeres, ese día nos sentimos muy contenta y tranquila y un corazón fuerte por ver los muchos de diferentes estaturas, colores como el maíz. Hay color amarillo, negro, blanco, pero todos somos una sola humanidad.
Ayer nació un caracol Un caracol de guerra en plena selva madre del sur, con luz de luna llena. Emprende el viaje al amanecer, el caracol sobre un rayo del día. No lo detiene la noche, ya ves, pasa y nadie lo mira. Una injusticia lo hará.
Well, hello and happy Friday to you all. My name is DJ Erickson, and sitting in with you now. And we're going to bring you the Friday edition of your Hard Knock Radio coming up here. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.0 FM, the Hood River and the Gorge, and 104.3 FM, Philomath and Corvallis. Coming up is your Friday edition with Dave D and Hard Knock Radio crew. And I just want you to say thank you for tuning in to listener-supported KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film Occupy the Farm, playing at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, April 2nd at 6:30 p.m.
Our main concern is water right now.
The university actually shut off our water.
What we're going to be doing is handing buckets over the fence.